Larry, welcome to the Nature and Nurture podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're an expert in oxytocin, the love hormone, and the neurobiology of attachment. And this is often studied not exclusively in humans, but across a range of mammalian species.
I've been, since the very earliest part of my career, interested in the neurobiology of behavior and the diversity in behavior. And let me just take you even back before I became a scientist when I was a kid. I grew up in South Georgia in the countryside. I spent a lot of time out in the woods and nature looking at animals and thinking, wow, all of these animals, they seem to be born with some kind of instinctive behavior. They know who they should mate with. They know who their own species is. And they know how to do the dances, the courtship rituals that they need to do to attract the mates. And then when they have babies, they know how to take care of the babies. They have some kind of internal knowledge that they're born with to be able to do those things. And then all the species have different behaviors. And I thought that was so cool. How does that happen? And so when I went to undergraduate at the University of Georgia, I was a biochemistry major, and we learned about the chemicals in the brain and then the genome. And I realized that every animal that's out there, deer, squirrel, even us, all the information to build the brain that gives us all of these instinctive behaviors is present in the single cell where you have the genome, one copy of the genome. And so I'm thinking, wow, how do you get from this DNA sequence to chemistry to the development of a brain to know how to make a mother know how to love her baby, to nurture the baby, or make a red bird, a cardinal, to know to mate with another cardinal, and all of these things. Actually, when I finally decided I wanted to be a scientist, I was interested in the animals in nature, not so much laboratory animals. Most people that study biology in the lab study white mice or white rats, but I was interested in the animals in nature. I found a lab at the University of Texas at Austin run by David Cruz, and he studied reptiles. And my PhD thesis was actually on lizards, sexual behavior of lizards, and not just any old lizards. These were lizards that were in the desert of Arizona and West Texas, where this species was all female. There are no male lizards in this species. They're females, and they reproduce by cloning themselves. But the cool thing about these females was that their ancestors were sexual species, the typical male, female. Males have to mate with a female. The sperm goes in the female, fertilizes the egg. And the ancestors, the females, would not produce an egg unless there was a male there courting them. The courtship behavior of the male actually turned the female's brain on to produce the hormones to make the eggs. When the species that I studied emerged, evolved, it was a hybridization event that occurred thousands of years ago. Their brain, they were all female. There are no males around, but the brain said, still don't make any egg until somebody tries to have sex with them. So that's a kind of a conundrum. And what they evolved was a kind of fluid gender, a transsexual kind of behavior, so that those females, depending on what hormones were being produced by their ovary at that time, they might think that they're a male. They're attracted to other females. They would do the whole courtship dance that the normal sexual species, the males, would do. They behaved like males sexually. They mounted the other females, and they would even copulate. So they would oppose their genitals and even have orgasm, but nothing would flow across because they're both females. But that behavioral stimulation of being mated by another animal of the species was enough to start the hormone production to make those females make eggs, which were automatically fertile because they were parthenogenetic. And so they would clone themselves, but they just needed that behavioral stimulation. So my PhD was like understanding in the brain, how do you evolve this kind of fluid sexual behavior so that one animal can one day think it's a female and behave like a female, then 2 or 3 days later, just depending on what chemicals are being secreted by the ovaries, they think that they're a male and they do the whole courtship ritual as a male. So to me, that was cool because this is nature. This is diversity in nature. And I was trying to understand that and comparing the brains of these guys with their ancestral species where the females are only behaving like females. After I did that research, which is a whole other story, it's a cool story, but...
I would like to delve into that, actually, before we get back to the oxytocin.
Okay, yeah.
I've heard of this red queen hypothesis for why sexual reproduction would emerge and be better than cloning, because mm-hmm. you're mixing your genes, you're getting more complexity. The red queen, the Alice in Wonderland reference of you have to run so fast just to stay in the same place. If you're cloning, you're literally staying in the same place. And if there's ever a parasite that, I guess, is uniquely evolved to attack your genome and there's nothing changing, you could just be wiped out. But when there's right. genetic shuffling every generation, it's harder for parasites to catch up with us. That seems really adaptive. And I guess there's other benefits to this genetic recombination you get with sexual reproduction. Why would you ever evolve away from that?
First of all, imagine that let's say you have five pairs, so you have 10 of the sexual species. You got five females laying eggs. On the other side, you've got 10. You've also got five pairs. There are 10 of the unisexual species. They're all females. So you got 10 animals laying eggs. So within the first bout of egg laying, on the sexual species, you've got five animals laying eggs. The other ones, you got 10 laying eggs. These are all female. They're all going to lay eggs. When their babies grow up, they're all going to lay eggs. For the sexual species, only the females are going to lay eggs. So in the very short run, the all-female species will explode in the environment. But you're absolutely right. And if the environment changes, if something changes in the environment, they don't have the mechanism of adaptability. So those species are probably short-lived on the order of thousands or tens of thousands of years. Whereas the sexual species, since they're always able to shuffle genes around and get new combinations, they can adapt more easily. So you can see one is it's not that they necessarily evolved to become unisexual. It's a byproduct of their hybridization. Hybridization in nature happens all the time, where you have two species coming together. And it's a byproduct of that is that they happen to be able to clone themselves. And then they explode in the environment. And then they stay there until an ice age comes or some big changes in the environment. And then they're going to get wiped out. But this is in nature. There's all these experiments going on all the time.
I had no idea you also had this expertise, Larry. And it's really interesting to me because I study hormones and brain development in humans, sex hormones. Right now, all my research is on organizational effects of pubertal hormones on the brain during puberty. But before this, I studied how prenatal androgen exposure influenced masculinization of the brain and intersex disorders like congenital adrenal hyperplasia, where you have hyperactive adrenal glands and byproducts of precursor hormones, stenodione, gets converted into testosterone. So in females, they're masculinized, and this has lifelong personality differences. They're more tomboyish, they're more likely to grow up to be gay. And all that got me really interested in this question about the neurobiology of gender, because we think of gender as this more social, subjective experience. So it's pretty much independent of your physiology. You can have organs, sex organs of one sex, but then internally maybe feel like the opposite sex. And people don't seem to be as aware of the complexity, but then when they are, they'll point at different species, like the lizards you're mentioning. I've heard of some fish as well, fish that are either hermaphroditic or that change genders midway through their lifespan.
Yeah, there's lots of examples. There are even examples in human populations where there are mutations and enzyme
hydroxyl reductase.
That converts testosterone to DHT. And these are in the Dominican Republic. There's a high concentration where they're boys, they're born, but they have ambiguous genitalia, or they look like females because the testosterone is not converted to the most potent androgen, DHT. And so pre-pubertatively, the parents think they're boys, either that they're girls. They have female-like genitalia. But then when puberty comes and then they start making massive amounts of testosterone, it's enough to actually change the genitalia. And so then they basically change their gender roles at puberty. But back to the lizards, just one example. There are many examples in nature of gender or diversity in gender or sexual preference, orientation, things like that. And lizards are just one example. And you talked about organization of steroids, and that was exactly what I studied, was these, the brain of males and females are similar before, or early in development, before steroid hormones are being secreted. And steroid hormones can shift the brain more towards a masculine side or to a feminine side. There's not just two slots. They're not male or female. The hormones act, and then they push them in one direction or another direction, or don't move at all or something like that. And so what we believed happened in these lizards is that they became hypersensitive to steroid hormones because they have three copies of the genome. They're triploid, which is also weird. Instead of two copies of their genome like we have, they have three copies of their genome. So they have three copies of every gene. So they increased dosage of steroid receptors. And then the steroids early in life is enough. That increased sensitivity to steroids is enough to take a female and shift her a little bit towards the male side. And then depending on what her ovarian cycle, even humans have cycles of estrogen and progesterone that go up and down. Well, the brain of a slightly masculinized lizard is like teeter-tottering between being male-like and being female-like. It just shows you, you can look in nature and you can see all kinds of diversity, and much of that diversity is most likely also going to be represented in our own species.
I've been really interested in how for hormones, both for sex hormones and for oxytocin, the physiological effects, they're mimicked by the brain and cognitive effects. For example, testosterone, you think of as a male sex hormone, primary role is to produce sperm and facilitate male physiological development. But then also at the psychological level, it's involved in aggression and sexual attraction and all these things that are like indirectly contributing to that very physiological process. And same thing with oxytocin. Oxytocin, the maternal care hormone, on one hand, at the basic physiological level, it's facilitating muscle contractions for birth and labor and for breastfeeding, but then it's also involved in the psychology of maternal care. And then estrogen and progesterone, same thing. You see these physiological cycles across the menstrual cycle, but then also the behavioral effects. It's like sex drive is linked to estrogen as well, which peaks just before ovulation, and all of it like pieces together at multiple levels of analysis.
Yeah, so I always teach this in my classes. This is a fundamental behavioral neuroendocrinology principle. Let's take estrogen and progesterone, for example. And I always use the example of a cat, because female cats, they go into heat. Anybody who's had a female cat go into heat, they will know the power of those hormones. And what happens is all females in pretty much all species, estrogen is secreted by the ovary to prepare the uterus for the being able to harbor the babies, the embryos, to develop. So the estrogen is preparing the uterus, making proliferation of blood vessels and everything. And then you have progesterone to do the same thing. So the ovary is signaling out these hormones. The body is responding, ready to get pregnant. But how do you get pregnant? You also got to tell the brain, hey, get pregnant, right? So a female cat, they hate tomcats. They don't hang around male cats. Except at the moment when that estrogen has been high for a few days, and then that progesterone is about to peak, it tells the brain, you're about to ovulate. You're about to put an egg out. You need to get some sperm. And that the female, a cat will do anything. They'll jump off of I had a friend who had a cat she went into heat. She jumped off of the second floor building. She had never been outside of the apartment. But when she came into heat, she leaped off the second floor building and was gone for a few days. And they were distraught. They lost their cat. They ran away. But it eventually came back in a few days, all disheveled and everything. But it came back home. And that's the power of these hormones. And so when I was a graduate student, I could give hormones to these lizards and I can make them do incredible sexual behavior. They would be so sexually excited just by giving the chemistry. So that was why I got the idea. I wanted to study the chemistry of sexual behavior, but also diversity. Why are we all different? How does differences arise in nature from an evolutionary perspective? So this is how I got to the bulls. Sorry, I took a long way to get to how I started studying love and bonding in bulls. It's not because I'm interested in love necessarily and bonding, although I shouldn't say that. I hope my wife isn't listening. I am interested in love, but I got to this because of a more circuitous route. I was interested in how do species that look the same have different behaviors? How can your genome, which is a sequence of A's, G's, C's, and T's, generate random mutations to give you diversity in behavior that natural selection can then select on? And so I read a paper in 1993 published in Nature about pair bonding in these monogamous prairie bulls. It was about vasopressin and pair bonding at that time. Then I realized that there are other kinds of bulls that look exactly the same, different species. But they look the same. They're genetically very similar, but they're totally promiscuous. So from my perspective, you've got a monogamous guy a pair that they mate. When they mate, a transformation happens, and then they just want to be together, and then they spend the rest of their life trying to raise offspring together. Then you've got another animal that mates, and after mating, the female goes off and has her babies alone, like 95% of all other mammals do. This is the most common strategy in mammals. Females raise babies by themselves. And the males are just trying to find another female to mate with. There's no bonding whatsoever. And some other work, Tom Insel had done some work like before this to show that, and Sue Carter, I should say, did the first work with oxytocin, showing that oxytocin released when the animals are mating in the brain is what causes them to form that bond. And so what we did was to look in the brain to see what's different between the monogamous and the non-monogamous species. And we found that the distribution of receptors in the brain is different between the two species. And in particular, one part of the brain that's important for reward and reinforcement and even addiction is loaded with oxytocin receptors in the monogamous species and not in the non-monogamous species. And we know that those receptors that are in that addiction area are the ones that are responsible for the animals forming this bond. So that's how I got to the bulls.
There's a huge neurobiology validating this artistic symbolism as love is a drug.
Yes. Actually, yes. I really think so. Our brains did not evolve to become addicted to drugs, hijack natural systems that evolved for other purposes. And our brain dopamine, nucleus accumbens, striatal areas are there for other purposes. And I think that love is just one example of a natural addiction. Addiction has negative connotation, but love is really, there's really not much negative there. It's actually a positive kind of addiction. The brain becomes really attached to another individual. And actually, so that's rare, bonding between a male and a female. Like I said, 95% of species don't do it. So I was interested, like, where does that come from? How do you get a species that suddenly is able to form bonds? And I think it actually comes back to the original function of oxytocin in all species, which you just already mentioned, and that is giving birth. So the word oxytocin comes from the Greek that means quick birth. It was known since the early 1900s that this was a chemical that was produced in the brain and the hypothalamus. It's released from the pituitary. When a mother is getting ready to give birth, it's released in a pulsatile manner, and it causes the uterus to contract and then to be squeezed out to give birth. After the baby's born, the baby suckles the breast, and that stimulation of the breast sends signals back up to those oxytocin neurons, and then they pulse fire again. And those pulses goes down into the breast and causes the muscles to contract in the breast to eject the milk. But in order for a mother to eject milk, she has to want to let that baby suckle, right? And so it turns out that oxytocin, this is that principle that we talked about earlier, the same molecules that's causing birth, that causing her to be able to deliver milk to the baby is causing her brain to think, ah, this baby is the most special baby in the world. And I want to take care of this baby. And it's amazing. I was just in Africa a couple of weeks ago doing some conferences there. And I went to see the wildebeest migration in Tanzania. And there's a field, there's thousands of wildebeest. And it's at the time of the giving birth. And there were dozens and dozens of animals on in front of me that were the mothers had just given birth. And to me, they all looked exactly the same, but they had given birth that morning. Yet the mother and the baby of each one was bonded with each other already. And so there was a strong drive going on in that mother's brain, as well as that baby's brain, to stay with the mom and for the mom to know who her baby is. And they would get mixed up, but they would always find their babies. So an important role of oxytocin is not just to give birth, to be able to lactate, or even to be able to take care of babies, but to actually bond with that specific baby. And all mothers know exactly who their baby is. I see babies and they all, a lot of them look the same to me. I confuse them all, but a mother knows exactly. And so that's one of the roles of oxytocin, is it's bonding with the baby. So it made sense to me that the same molecule could be involved in bonding of a male to a female or a female to a male. We're just changing it's the same process. You're just changing who you're bonding to. You're becoming more flexible. You're not just bonding at the moment of birth, but another time when you have oxytocin release. So vaginal cervical stimulation is what causes oxytocin release powerfully. And that happens during sex. It also is released during social touch, in humans, eye-to-eye contact. So we're learning now there's a lot more interesting roles for oxytocin than just giving birth or even maternal behavior. It has more broad implications for relationships.
You mentioned this pulsatile hormone release. And now that I'm thinking about it, like every single type of touch that seems relevant here, whether it's the baby suckling on a breast or the physical act of sex or any touching stimulation, even a massage, it's not just this static touch and then it's like flow hormones as if it's a sort of a magnetic electric charger where you just need to stay in place to send the chemical or the stimulus. It's all about this back and forth. Is that physical touch literally mimicking in the brain this pulsing signal you mentioned?
I'm not sure that the physical touch is mimicking. I think they're two different processes. There may be some similarities, but it's just for in the brain, you need to release the impulses so that you can easily tell when a new stimulation comes, right? So you pulse and then you chew up, you destroy it so that, or you can, each pulse leads to a contraction. But let me just get back to what you said, because social touch is very important. And it's not just pure mechanical, okay? Because going to a doctor's office and getting touched doesn't release oxytocin, right? It's also not very arousing, right? And I would ask the people that are watching this to do a little experiment if they have someone near them. If you take your arm and you stroke your arm like this and see how it feels, and then let someone else stroke it in the exact same way, it feels totally different. So it's partly our perception. And so it is the combination of the touch, but also some sort of recognition that this is a pleasant situation, this is a social context. All of that gets integrated, and then that is causing oxytocin release within the brain. You know, we got to remember that oxytocin can be released in the body, like the uterus and the breast. It changes our behavior and our perceptions. It's really changing in our brain. And what is it doing in our brain? Highest technology science, doing electrophysiology and all optogenetics and these kinds of experiments have shown that what oxytocin does when it's released in the brain is actually silences the noise so that the signal can come through very clearly. Okay. For example, just as an analogy, if you have a television screen or a computer screen where there's a lot of static, a lot of grainy noise coming in there, there may be an image back there, but it's not very clear to you. But imagine if you had a remote or a knob that you could turn to make the noise go away. the signal now is very clear. And that's what oxytocin is doing in the brain. Neurons are always firing, bup, 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 like popcorn. It's just a little static noise. And we're not really attuned to anything, right? You get on a subway, or walk down New York City street, there's lots and lots of people around, but you don't remember those people. But when you go to shake someone's hand, you look at them in the eyes, oxytocin is being released. It sort of silences all of that noise so that the individual that you're with at that time becomes very salient in your brain. And your brain can make a memory of the face, of even the sound, and all of that. And that's actually, when that is really combined with, say, an intimate moment, having sex or repeated just intimacy, where you have oxytocin release plus the dopamine, which is also involved in addiction, right? Dopamine is like a key player in addiction. Cocaine releases or causes a lot of dopamine in the brain. So you've got a combination of your brain is tuned in to the social world around you, that person that you're with, if you're having sex, for example, because oxytocin is being released. And then also you're experiencing the pleasure from the dopamine, the reward and reinforcement of the sex from the dopamine. And you put those two together in a neural circuit kind of way in the brain. And we think that somehow creates new connections so that a sort of social engram in the brain that represents your new partner becomes hardwired or increases synaptic connectivity to the reward system in the brain so that that point on, that partner is inherently rewarding and therefore you want to be with that partner. So I think of a bonding love with our romantic partners very much like an addiction that involves dopamine system, but it also involves this oxytocin system, which is turning us into the other. You put those two together, we want to be with that person that our brain has learned releases all that dopamine.
Let's also talk a lot about reward prediction error in the context of dopamine. So it's not just a matter of getting a nice level of reward and then you feel good, but it's all about expectations. So if you're expecting a reward and it's not as good, even if you still get something, like you think you have an amazing winning lottery ticket and it turns out like you won $10, $10 is better than nothing. But if you are expecting more, you actually might experience a dopamine dip and experience disappointment. And I'm thinking about that in coupling with this social experience you mentioned, or even the idea of if you stroke your own arm, it doesn't really feel as good as if someone else does it. Does that have to do with the prediction about if you're touching yourself, you know exactly what's going to happen? So there's no unexpectedness to it. And it's more rewarding when you have a little bit of excitement or uncertainty?
Very well could be. And when you think about, at least for these voles that I study, when they're having sex for the first time, there is no certainty about what this experience is going to be like. It's all new to them. And I can imagine most time when people also get together with intimacy, there is not a lot of prediction. On the other hand, if you're married for 10 years, there's a lot of prediction there. And then if you have expectations and your partner fails to meet those expectations, then you get that negative prediction error, which can be actually not rewarding. I'm sure that that plays into that bonding in some way like that. Yeah.
Right. Esther Perel talks a lot about this paradox of intimacy, where on one hand, true intimacy is being so close and vulnerable that you know everything about your partner and you can predict their behavior. And the more you love them, the closer you are, in some sense, the better you're able to do that. But as that happens, so too does the excitement of novelty go down, because if you can predict everything. Yeah, exactly.
They become boring. Yeah. We've done some work in voles that get to this point too, not that they get boring, but the fact that relationships change over time. I think about the beginning of a relationship, the beginning of a pair bond, whether it be voles or probably in people as well, what I've experienced and what I've seen. In the beginning, there's a lot of oxytocin and there's a lot of dopamine, right? Everything's exciting. You can't wait to be with them, blah, blah, blah. It's exciting. And in my own marriage, when I first got married to my wife, I remember soon after we got married, we got a puppy dog. And every day when I would come home from work and I would just walk through the kitchen door, my wife and my puppy dog would be equally excited to see me. But now we've been married for more than 15 years. The puppy dog is all grown. I come home from work. My puppy dog is still equally excited to see me every day when I come home. My wife, not so much. Maybe the first thing she said was, can you take out the trash? So things change. Yet I still come home every day. And so this tells me that there's a couple of different aspects of this bonding. What we found out in the bulls that have already bonded, we were asking, what happens when you lose your partner? Because we know in people, losing partners increases mortality. It increases cardiovascular disease. It decreases immune function, increases depressive-like behavior in people. But when we took these little voles that were bonded and we took their partner away, we found that they became depressed. We did rodent test of depression, and they showed high levels of depression behavior when they lost their partner. And then we did some other experiments that suggested that when they lost their partner, the oxytocin neurons became suppressed. So they actually went through a withdrawal of oxytocin. So that negative experience of oxytocin being gone is what led to that depressive-like behavior. And we can actually take the partner away and at the same time infuse a little bit of oxytocin into this nucleus accumbens, this reward area. And they didn't get depressed if they lost their partner. So that grieving-like behavior that they showed when they lost their partner seemed to be due to the lack of oxytocin. And I think that's a mechanism that keeps us together for a long time because like I said, I was in Africa a couple of weeks ago. I was gone for 3 weeks. I really missed my wife. I really wanted to come back. I was excited to come back. So in nature, when pair-bonded animals are together and then they separate, they could just keep going. But even if they've been together for a long time, something needs to draw them back. And very much a junkie who is addicted to drugs. And when they don't have the drugs, the most important thing for them, their most strongest motivation is to find more drugs. So that's another sort of connection with love and addiction.
We talked about this first oxytocin study that you mentioned in one of my seminar classes, where you're comparing monogamous prairie voles with non-monogamous meadow voles and looking at the oxytocin and dopamine systems and finding that they're more coupled in the monogamous voles. And this was very polarizing to us because I think half of us, including myself, just looked at that and thought, this is amazing. They're using the same love hormone and the same reward circuitry as we are in humans. So they're clearly pair bonding out of love. There must be some subjective experience there. And the other half looked at it and said, in a reductionist way towards humans, we know that for them, it's all just this neurobiology. And for us, it's no different. It's just more complicated. So like being dismissive or reductionist of love, saying it's all just chemicals in your brain, it's not real. And that's really interesting, polarizing opposite perspectives you can take.
Yeah, my view is that there's somewhere in between. And so I think of it from an evolutionary perspective. Okay. These voles are not in love. Okay. So I don't know if you can show a picture of them. Actually, I have a picture right here just so that the audience can see what they look like. This is a family of voles. They're about the size of hamsters. They're from the Midwestern United States. This is a male and a female. I'm quite sure they are not in love. So their behavior is just motivated by these neural circuit systems that are causing them to want to be together and to spend time together. I'm convinced that our bonding, our love, also uses these same neural circuits and the same neurochemistry. For example, there was a study done by a German group where they took men that were in monogamous relationships and they showed them pictures of either their partner or another woman that college students ranked to be equally attractive. And they asked the men to rank how beautiful that person was in the picture from 1 to 10. And then they gave the men either oxytocin or placebo. And what they found was that in these men that were in relationships, if they got placebo, they might rate their partner as like a 7. My partner is better than average. 7's pretty good. But when those same men took oxytocin, they ranked them as 8 or 9. So the oxytocin, the same chemical, made them more attractive. So there's no doubt there that this is a chemical changing this person's perception. It did not make the other women more attractive. So it was specifically enhancing the attractiveness, the perceived attractiveness of the partner, not other women. And they did this in a brain scanner. And in that brain scanner, they asked what part of the brain is really activated by the combination of seeing the partner and with the oxytocin. And that area was the nucleus accumbens. And that oxytocin receptors in the nucleus accumbens is what creates the bond between male and female prairie voles. So there's no doubt that at least there is a lot of overlap between love and bonding in humans and in voles. But I believe that's a sort of a subcortical thing, a subcortical process that's driving our behavior. Much like sexual desire is not just a, I think I should be sexually interested in somebody. It's something that happens subcortically. We're automatic, we're just interested. And then our cortex maybe tacks on some things about it. And so that's what love is. Love is, there is a subcortical process, very ancient process, that very similar to what happens in mothers, human mothers, but also chimpanzee mothers, rhesus macaque mothers, rat mothers, cat mothers, all the other mothers. That same neurochemical process is happening. But because we have this elaborated neocortex, we can also add language. We can add thoughts about the future. All of the language of love comes into play, but it's really driven by these subcortical systems. So that's my view of this. You know, it's a combination of the two.
So they couldn't cognitively express their love. Non-human right. animals, but right. just in
they
that subcortical
groom each other, but yeah, they don't.
Yeah,
it's not. It's just the motivation. Right?
That affective experience, though, would you say that they're experiencing love, or would you say that the lizards are experiencing sexual arousal? They don't communicate it, but they're clearly acting aroused.
I would say they're acting aroused. So their behavior is the same. If you lizards have very simple brains, their cortex is very simple. It's not even anything like our cortex. I don't think that they're experiencing anything like that we experience. But they show very strong sexual motivation exactly like us, right? And also fish, the same thing. The same steroids. And even if you look in the brain of fish and lizards and amphibians and birds and in mammals and in primates and in humans, the location of estrogen receptors and androgen receptors and progesterone receptors that are orchestrating the sexual desire in all of these animals is the same, not so much in the cortex, but in these core deep hypothalamic regions. And so the drive is the same. So I think if you look at a lizard, they don't have the same cognitive experience that we do, but they're motivated to act. And then fish are around before lizards. And then you look at other birds and it's a continuum. And as you get more complex, like mammals, where you start to have cortex, and then primates, and then humans. You're just adding layers on top of these deep, ancient driving circuits. Even worms have sex. They don't have brains anything like ours. You can get C. elegans with just a few hundred neurons. They can have sex between the males and the females that are not hermaphrodites, or that are hermaphrodites. But so you can get behaviors from very simple organisms. And I think that those fixed motivations are around for a long time. And then we happen to enjoy the richness that our cortex can provide. And then so love has sparked some of the greatest literature and architecture. And the Taj Mahal is a famous building in India that was built somewhere around love.
And do you say then to the Sapolsky style determinists who say that it's all just hormones in your brain and responding to the environment in a very neurobiological, mechanistic way. So you think you're experiencing love out of your own volition, but it's really just, you can reduce it all to brain chemistry. Is there room for free will there?
No doubt in my mind that all of our experiences, love and our imagination and everything is absolutely the result of brain circuitry in combination with chemistry, right? If you remove the brain, you don't have any of that, right? So it is there. What you just described from the Sapolsky point of view, I think some of that is true, that we are responding to all of these things. And maybe if we had infinite knowledge of every neuron and every synapse and every chemical in the brain, we might be able to predict things in the future, everybody's thoughts or whatnot, but we don't have that. And I think that there's enough room for stochastic kind of events in the brain when you're talking about trillions of synapses and things like that, with neurotransmitter vesicle releases and things like that. There's enough room for sort of chaos, stochastic events kinds of things, where you would not be able to predict everything. And so somewhere in there is where free will comes from. So no one behaves exactly the same to the same stimulus. We have the opportunity to take that information in. Yeah, steroids may do all the same things to us. Dopamine may do the same things, but we also have all of our life experiences and even pre-life experiences and all these kinds of things that created the brains that we have. And then somehow there is something that I believe it, free will, an emergent property of the incredible complexity of the neural circuitry in the brain.
I want to pivot now to talking about development. So you mentioned way back, once an infant is born, there's a massive release of oxytocin, both from the mother and from the infant, and that's involved in the pair bonding and the recognizing each other, whereas in other species like ducks and geese, there's imprinting, but the imprinting is primarily visual. You get these famous examples of Conrad Lorenz walking around with a bunch of little ducklings thinking that he's their mother because he's the first thing they saw moving when they're outside, when they hatch from their eggs. And in humans, and I guess in all mammals, we don't have the same type of imprinting, but the argument is that we do have hormone-based imprinting.
Yeah, and maybe the difference is in birds, okay? Giving birth to the baby is dissociated from the baby emerging from the egg, right? So you lay an egg, probably the same for dinosaurs and alligators. You lay an egg, and then the baby has to come out. And also, birds are very rapidly evolving in terms of their coloration and feathers and stuff like that. To me, it makes sense to have a system where, you know, whatever your parent looks like, that's who you should be with. Because that way you don't have to evolve the innate knowledge of your species. You just look at who you're born with. Yeah, so the difference is that with mammals, then suddenly you are intricately connected to your mother's endocrine system and your baby is connected to yours. And then suddenly is born. And at that point, you have to be, they're both would be recognizing each other, especially for the wildebeest that I talked about, but sheep, goats, things like that. They're all born in herds, deer. They're able to walk around pretty quickly. So you need to have that kind of quick bond. And one of the first things the animals have to do when they're born, when they come out of the mother, is suckle the breast. The brains have taken advantage of all these hormonal processes that are associated with birth, being able to give milk, suckling, and then use that same chemistry that's going around to signal the brain, pay attention right now to very, if you're a zebra, pay attention to the stripes of your zebra baby, because her stripes are very different from every other 10,000 zebras around you. And you remember that stripes, and that's what they do. It's pretty amazing.
People talk a lot about imprinting in this postnatal context, but I recently learned about sexual imprinting, where in some species of birds, where you have bright coloration and sex differentiation in males, but the females across a wide variety of species are relatively gray and drab, and it's harder to tell them apart even for a bird expert. You get this innate recognition of sexual partners from females. So females innately seem to know which patterns of coloration are attractive in males. But in some species of birds, males sexually imprint on the first females that they see, and experimenters manipulated this. So they expose sexually mature male birds to the wrong species of female, basically a different gray drab bird, and they attempt to mate, but they can't mate successfully because they're not part of the same species. And then they reintroduce the right female, and they won't mate because they recognize them as if they're a different species. And I don't know if there's any relation there to how sexual behavior in mammals works, but that I thought was really cool because it shows that whatever's happening brain development wise, it's not just innately or based on sex hormones. There's something unique to this window of sexual maturation where you get heightened plasticity and there's some learning going on too.
And that's a very smart system, right? It's okay. Females are very hard to tell apart, and also, and it, so it'd be very hard to learn the species genetically in the genome, encode each different species female who are all pretty much look the same. So look at who is raising you. Look and see if they have two little things here, a dot here, whatnot, what makes them unique, and then bond with that. Whereas for the males, they're all very unique. Maybe they have different bright colors. And so that's maybe something easier to encode genetically in the female brain. There were studies done in similar kinds of studies done by Keith Kendrick many years, 2000s, where they would take sheep and goats and raise a baby sheep with a goat and or a baby goat with a sheep. And I don't remember all of the details, but I do remember that, yeah, it was for in some cases that the animals, whoever raised them, who they were attracted to sexually. They were attracted to the species that raised them. Goats and sheep are very similar, but they're different species. But if a sheep is raised by a goat mother, then when that sheep grows up, it's sexually attracted to. So yeah, there is some kind of learning, and maybe that also affects who we are attracted to as our partners as well. We want somebody who's a little bit similar, reminds us of our parents in some way.
I know in humans and rodents, there's research that I think it's based on smell. So even if you're looking at kin, so adopted kin that you're raised with, you won't be attracted to them, even though genetically you could be, like they're not related to you. So whatever it is that's making you avoid incest, it doesn't seem to be encoded in the genome. It seems to be this learning and growing up with them over long periods of time, and I guess becoming accustomed to their smell.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just seems like a very practical solution. It'd be difficult to organize a system in the brain, in the genome, to create the brain that can detect always who is genetically related to you. But you can be pretty sure that if when you are in this early developmental window and you're smelling someone all the time, that person's probably related to you. Be attracted to somebody else.
Yeah. There's a bit of a paradox there, because on one hand, we're seeing that early experience to a certain type of animal determines who you are attracted to. And in a different context, it's determining who's off limits, but essentially everyone else who looks similar that isn't around you, you're attracted to.
Yeah. So one is the sort of species detection. Who is what's the right species? And then the other one is a much more fine brain thing of differentiating individuals. And yeah, it's interesting. I don't know if anything has been done in terms of the neurobiological mechanisms involved in those things. But yeah, to me, it's just fascinating how evolution can solve these problems, right? The animals need to mate with their own species, but they need to mate with someone who is not very closely related to them, so they get genetic diversity. And evolution has come up with all of these really neat, fascinating mechanisms that can be explored in the laboratory and to figure out from a neural circuit basis and a chemical basis. We may not know the answer to these questions now, but this is the same kind of excitement that got me interested in the voles in the first place, or different species. You've got nature is just so fantastic. You have so much diversity out there. And that diversity comes out originally from mutations in genes, random mutations that are creating all of these sort of random experiments in the brain, many of which make the animal not better than before. But some of them give it the ability to do something that actually gives it an advantage over others, and then that survives. And then you iterate that over millions and tens of millions of individuals, and then generations, and thousands of generations. You can really get changes in behaviors and honing in on very precise mechanisms that are just incredible. So I think this field of science, of understanding the brain and the source of diversity and all of that, there's many years and generations of scientists that will be able to continue to answer exciting questions here.
I'm thinking of a few related studies in primates. I don't know if they're related to oxytocin at all, but it has to do with sex hormones and puberty. So they're opposite findings based on sex. So if you're exposed to a non-related male around puberty as a male, then it inhibits puberty. And I guess the idea there, the evolutionary idea, is there's sexual competition. It doesn't make sense for you to mature and fight this rival who's already fully mature and dominant. But then from the female perspective, then you see puberty happens faster if you're exposed to more males. And I guess the evolutionary idea there is there are eligible partners here. Go on speed development so you can have your offspring faster. And even in humans, some people have linked stepfathers to earlier pubertal timing in females, which makes sense because you have this new male who isn't your genetic father in the house in close proximity to you. And I don't know if it's hormonal or what, but there's some sort of trigger there of, from an evolutionary perspective, puberty can happen earlier because there are eligible partners around.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It just shows the ability to adapt, right? Because if you're an animal that, if you're a male and there's another male that's not related to you around, and you went on and developed your sexuality, it would be conflict, like you said, and likely death because you're a young guy. And it reminds me of lions, where if there's a female lion and she's got babies, and a male lion comes in, the first thing a male lion does, if the other lion is gone, the male lion, he will kill all those babies because he wants to bring her back into estrus so that he can get her pregnant and then have those babies. And so if that, the case of that you just mentioned about the young boy, the young male in puberty, beginning puberty, if he comes into puberty early, or at the normal time, there will be conflict and it's possible that they would die and not be able to pass the genes on. So it's a way of survival.
I'm glad you brought up.
I don't know if the same sort of thing as you described in females, I don't know if that really works in humans and it's the same kind of mechanism, but if you describe the same thing in a monkey, it makes a lot of sense that the female would come in to eat because that is a male who is just as any other male, good enough to fertilize her babies and produce offspring that are not related. From a male who's not related to her. It's just every possible combination of differences in behavior that you can imagine. Somehow nature has figured out how to solve the problems.
I'm glad you brought up the lions because that reminded me of one last big subject of oxytocin research that we haven't touched on yet, which is that oxytocin doesn't just promote pro-social care. There's some research showing that it promotes care for in-group members, but also promotes, maybe through vasopressin, out-group aggression. They call this the mama bear effect, where mama bear is like all lovey to her cubs, but fierce to anyone else.
Actually, I think that if you Google oxytocin, you can find the cuddle hormone or the love hormone or all these different, even the moral molecule, all these names that get attached to it. And those are all very oversimplistic. If you think of it in the context of a mother, it's a maternal hormone. What should a mother do? If a mother, wildebeest, has her baby just born, and she's loving on that baby, she's nurturing that baby, she shouldn't love everything that comes around. She should also become very aggressive toward the out-group being fine. And in rats, even in laboratory rats, the out-group is any male. Because male rats don't like babies. They'll kill babies, especially male rats and mice, for example, are infanticidal. They kill babies. And so if you put a male rat in a cage with a female who's given birth, she loves those babies. Loves. So okay, she's bonded with those babies and she's motivated to take care of and nurture those babies. But she doesn't nurture that male. She fights that male. These are called oxytocin receptors are in different parts of the brain that are doing different things. In some parts of the brain, it's activating the reward reinforcement system, it's quieting the noise, it's allowing them to have the perception of exactly who the babies are and linking that to the reward system. At the same time, it's increasing the amygdala activity that's involved in a threat response and attack. But let me just get back to this, the male, like the lion that attacks the babies. Mice do the same thing. So male mice will kill babies, okay? But there's this really cool thing that happens in a rat, in a male mouse. He mates. From that point, he'll kill babies. But the frequency of killing babies goes down, down until about 19, 20 days after sex. He doesn't kill babies anymore. Why is that? The gestation period of mice is 21 days. So his brain is set to shut off infanticidal behavior coinciding when his baby should be born. So that's a really also a very interesting process that's happening in the brain of a male. It's just sort of shifting off that infanticidal to ensure that he doesn't kill his babies. So a neat example of how the brain shifts, even though he's not experiencing the hormones of pregnancy, his brain has some memory formation in a timer that, hey, you had sex. There's a female around you pregnant with your babies, start shutting down the infanticidal behavior.
Then you see from the female perspective, and I think there's some work on this in primates as well, that there'd be incentive to be especially promiscuous, because then every male hypothetically could be the father and hypothetically is going to care towards her and her offspring, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So I should mention this. We talked about monogamy and these bulls are pair bonding. But like humans, pretty much all monogamous species are not 100% monogamous. Both the males and the females will cheat from time to maximize their fitness. So there's a sexual conflict going on. And so in many species where a female, even if she's pair bonded, she's got a male who will take care of her babies. If she sees another male that's much more adapted, that's say strong or seems to be pretty fit, it's to her advantage to actually slip away from her partner and get pregnant by that other male and then come back and then have those babies. And that male thinks that he's the dad, so he will raise them. So it's opportunistic diversification of your offspring's genetics. And that's okay as long as don't get caught. And males often will also mate opportunistically as well. And in fact, in humans, it happens much more than you think. So there was some studies done from in vitro fertilization clinics around the world that shows different, even in different cultures, approximately 10% of children who think that they know who their biological dad is, that's not really their dad, because it is part of our biology, right? To not only to bond and become partners, but also, unfortunately, to sometimes have affairs. And that's happening more often than you think. It happens in nature and it happens in people as well.
I've heard that this oxytocin pair bond that we talk about with the dopamine reward system coupling, evolutionarily, it's optimized to last for 3 to 5 years, basically for the time period that an infant is most vulnerable. And then once the child is running around in the community, it doesn't exactly matter who the parents are so much, because there's some level of independence and there's more of this communal parenting, at least in our ancestral societies.
Yeah, I think that may be the case. I talked a little bit earlier about how the relationship changes over time. If you take a 10-year time frame, in the beginning, the first few years, it's very exciting and everything. And then things change. And then you stay together for other reasons. And you do miss your partner if you don't have them or whatnot. But also that we have built societal, cultural kinds of things to ensure the longevity of relationships, maybe beyond what it would be, say, 100,000 years ago, when our ancestors, our early humans, or 50,000 years ago, when there was no sort of constraints like that. I'm not sure how many of them would stay together for a long time. We're also diverse. There's also a lot of cultures in the world where there'll be males will have multiple female partners. So we're not strictly pair bonding or monogamous, I think, but mostly we are. Most cultures and most individuals, even in cultures where there are polygamous marriages, most males have one female. So the relationship does change. And sometimes it's better just to stay together economically and for a lot of other reasons, religiously. A lot of things are driving us to stay together. It very well could be that our brains are designed to develop a bond, keep it for a certain amount of time, and then decay. But I think what I often talk about when I talk to couples or talk about how you can use the science to strengthen your relationship, even though our brain may have some sort of entropy when it comes to these pair bonding circuits that would allow them to decay, we don't want that to happen necessarily. And so there are ways to strengthen that. So keep that oxytocin, keep that dopamine flowing, keep doing exciting things together, releasing the oxytocin together, and you can keep those bonds together that may otherwise have just decayed.
Any last tips on that, strengthening the love?
Yeah, I talk about, when I talk to these, in these kinds of seminars about, if you focus in on dopamine and the oxytocin, I remember I was earlier in my relationship with my wife, she would always want flowers. And I would say, oh, I'm not going to buy flowers, die. They cost money. It's a waste of money. I'm not going to get flowers this time. And then there was that negative prediction error. I could see it in her face. And then later on, though, I realized, okay, maybe this is a way to get dopamine. And then I could, you know, I'd give her flowers. And then I could see the dopamine released in her brain, right? And then we started going on date nights after our kids were older and stuff. We'd go on date nights, and both of us would have a good time talking to each other, looking at each other. And so those kinds of things. So think about things that you can do with your partner that releases both the oxytocin and the dopamine to re-strengthen those bonds, because otherwise they will decay. And so that's my recommendations I give to people who want to use the science of pair bonding to strengthen their own relationships.
I love how wide-ranging your work is, Larry, from lizards to prairie voles to love in human relationships.
Thank you. Yeah, I never thought it would be so wide-ranging when I was working with those little lizards, but you never know where your science is going to go.
Thank you very much for your time, Larry.
Okay, thanks for having me.